Lord, I want to thank you for tonight. I want to thank you for our gathering. Thank you, as always, for our Lord Jesus Christ, whom we come to know more about, to know and to grow. And I pray, Lord, that as we know and grow, we would take what we know and into the world we live in. May we be bright, shining lights. We meet a lot of people, and I pray that when they meet us, they would remember us, not for our beauty or ugliness or anything other than that what we know about Jesus and the light we shine. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, let's take a look. We are on chapter or lecture 4. For those of you who are new, if you're not, I'm going through basically using as my model, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, by Norm Geisler and Frank Turek. I'm not following it word for word, but I'm following it chapter by chapter, at least by topic. Let's take a look tonight, the arguments for the existence of God, at least a fourth argument. We're calling it the moral argument. The first one we've looked at is the ontological argument for the existence of God, which is the argument for existence and why anything exists at all. There has to be something that has always existed for anything to exist. That's ontological argument. The second argument is the cosmological argument for the existence of God. That is, when we look at the world and we know that there is a law called cause and effect, then how did everything get here? Who caused it? Well, in evolution goes back and says there was a Big Bang. Well, in the Big Bang, something had to explode. Who or what caused it? You have to make your way back to the beginning of something because everything's cause and effect. And where did that law of cause and effect come from? Who or what gave it? So the cosmological argument is to look at the world, cosmos, and say, how did it get here? Or we might call it the cause, C-A-U-S, logical argument. What caused the first thing that gave us everything? And then last week we looked at the teleological argument for the existence of God, which is a fancy way of saying there is design in the universe. Everything is designed. How did that design get here? Who or what designed it? It's one thing to be in a riverbed and reach down and pull out a rock. Well, the rock's been there. We could say that's been there for eternity. But if you reach down and pull out an arrowhead, well, that proves something designed it. It's one thing to see a boulder on the side of a mountain, but to see writing on the side of a mountain, that shows that intelligence has been there. Well, the world and the earth itself has design. And I showed you the arguments, just a handful of arguments that show design in the universe. Tonight we want to look at the moral argument for the existence of God. C.S. Lewis says, "Think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. You might just as well try to imagine a country where 2 and 2 made 5. And what this is going to move towards is that there are certain basic moral principles that we all adhere to. And we don't even need to be taught. They're just innate within all of us. So the argument, as we've looked at the review of ontological, cosmological, and teleological, is this. Number one, every law has a lawgiver. There is a moral law that we're all born with this innate idea of, therefore there is a moral lawgiver. It's just basic logic. There, everyone has a giver. We have that law, so there's a moral lawgiver. Who is he? Who or what? Why is there a moral law? Well, number one, the moral law is undeniable. Would anyone here today say that they can deny that there's a moral law? Let me put it to you this way. Has anyone ever come up to you and said, there are no moral absolutes? Now, to say there are no absolutes is a self-defeating statement. To say there's no moral absolutes is not self-defeating, yet it is absurd. There are no moral absolutes. What do they mean? Do they mean that killing is not always wrong? Do they mean that lying is not always wrong? There are no moral absolutes, yet there is a moral law. It's undeniable. Let's take a look. For those who deny this premise, you ask them, do you value your right to have this opinion? Right there's the self-defeating nature of it. Don't you think that they value their right to deny that there is a moral law? Or that there are no moral absolutes? Someone says, there's no moral absolutes. Well, do you value your right to hold that opinion? Well, yeah, value. Well, then you just proved there is a moral law, and you believe in moral absolutes. Folks want everyone to value them as people, even while they deny that there are values for all persons. We don't always believe that there are values for all people. Back in the days of, and it's still here, I shouldn't say it's in the past, but the days of thinking one race is greater than another, or the white man is supreme to the black man, they believed that there were no rights for these black people and all the names they called them. Well, that's changed a bit. We'll also look at why that changed. Many deny this truth, and they say there are no moral absolutes. So, insult them. I've told you this before. If someone comes up and says, Bill, I do not believe in moral absolutes. Figure out their skin color. Figure out their race, their genetic makeup, their whether they're male or female, and just insult everything about them. You do it anyway, right? And if they're offended, well, then they just proved their own selves wrong. Because they will value their right to be valued as people. And if you just call them a name where they are going to fire back and say, you can't call me that. You can't say that. What do you mean I can't? You just said there are no moral absolutes. Now be nice about it. You don't have to use foul language. But just insult them. See what they do. You no good, low life, sorry, piece of nothing. Well, if they sit there straight face and say, sorry, since there's no moral absolutes, I can't be angry. Well, then maybe they actually believe what they say. Go up and slug them the next time. Hit them in the face. Poke them in the eye. And if they object, say, well, why are you objecting? How can it be? You just said it's no wrong. There are no moral absolutes. Are you telling me that it's wrong for me to poke you in the eye? There's the absurdity of it. Now, again, you might want to have a gun just in case they come back. But this is how you illustrate in their own lives their own absurdity. Tell them that they just gave you permission to do so. If offended, then they prove that they do believe in moral absolutes. Bill, do you have your hand up? Quickly.
How would it be if we just call them stinky, smelly,
sure.
Sinners?
Well, I do that every week, and you people seem to love it. I can't find a worse word to call you in church. But
stinky and smelly was doing pretty good.
But you know why? Yeah, I like the stinky, smelly Sunday. The reason you don't object is because you know it's true. Who would not object? Or who would object? Those who don't think it's true. Or just don't want to be called that. Maybe they know it's true and they come to church to forget that that's what they are, right? Number two, we know the moral law exists by our reactions to the things that happen. Treat people unfairly and they will appeal to the moral law. For example, and Geisler uses a great example, a student who does not believe in moral absolutes. Assume this student is writing a paper, you're the professor, and they write this paper about how they do not believe there are any absolutes in the world. I believe there are no absolutes. I believe that every man should think as this man should think or this woman should think. And they turn in their paper and they're all nice and happy about it. You just give them an F. And you turn it back to them and they are going to do what? You think if they really believed it, they're going to say, "Yep, got an F." It's the way it goes, right? Can't be right or wrong, but they will argue. Why did you give me an F? Well, aren't you the student that said you don't believe in moral absolutes? That's me. That's my paper. Well, I didn't like your paper. I gave you an F. They will demand fairness because they value fairness every time. All male relativists believe that their wife cheating on them is absolutely wrong. Don't you think? Take a male relativist that says, you can't call right, you can't call wrong, wrong. You can't do those things. Well, if his wife cheats on him, he's going to think that's wrong. Why? All agnostics and atheists believe in one form of government over another. Why? Because one is better? Who says? Why does one group of people believe that the Democrats are right, and another group believe Republicans are right, and another believes the libertarians are right, or anarchists are right? Each one has this opinion because they think it's right. Hence, they believe they may be against all morality of one particular group. Being against it puts them in a category of what they think is right. They think all that's wrong because they think they're right. Do you see where it goes? Every one of them, by their own opinion, if they hold one single opinion and are willing to fight for it, well, then they show there is a moral absolute. The moral law is the basis for human rights. Consider that when terrorists bombed the World Trade Center, or when the Nazi war criminals were brought to trial in Nuremberg, in the case of the Nazis, they were convicted of violating basic human rights as defined by the moral law. War crimes. What's a war crime? I thought all was fair in love and war. Why are the Nazis wrong? Aren't the Jews inferior to the Germans? I mean, you and I say no because we believe in God. But if we don't believe in God, don't the strong survive? If you are not a believer in the Creator God, you have no opinion. You can have no opinion about the Nazis being wrong in World War II. You can't. You just have to say, well, that's what they think. And survival of the fittest. If the Jews are going to rise to the occasion, they'll beat the Nazis. And if the Nazis beat them, well, then the Nazis must be stronger and the Jews have no basis for their survival. Is that an opinion worth holding? Well, because we do believe in moral absolutes, we say no. But where do our moral absolutes come from? Where do we get the idea that one race is not stronger or better, we should say, than another? They can be stronger, they may not be better. Where'd you get that? Who taught you that? Who taught you as a baby to go to a candy jar after mama told you not to touch the candy jar? Who taught you to challenge? No one had to. Is that right or wrong? Shouldn't a parent or mom just go into the candy jar? Go ahead and eat the broken glass. It's no right or wrong. Because having your mouth all scarred up with shards of glass is not inherently wrong. And I can't tell you not to do it. Who wrote that law, by the way? Who establishes man's basic human rights and who gave them that authority? And yet, everyone believes there is a standard. So who gave it? Where did it come from? The moral law is the unchanging standard of justice. C.S. Lewis, when he was an atheist, he said, "As an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" Now, as you know, C.S. Lewis became a staunch Christian. But as a thinker, he began to think, "What? All right, if I'm calling this wrong, what am I basing it on?" If an atheist tells you that you are wrong, ask them, what are you basing that on? How do you know what's right to where you can tell me I'm wrong? Don't you not believe that there are no moral absolutes? Or don't you believe there are no moral absolutes? So why is the Holocaust called evil? I use the Holocaust because it's used in the book, and it's also one of the most heinous things that we've ever heard of in our planet, and certainly in our generation. But if there are no moral absolutes, and keep this in mind, if you meet someone who says there are no moral absolutes, just default to the Holocaust. Was that wrong? And if you think it's wrong, why do you think that? Who told you that? Because essentially, it's murder, isn't it? And we all think murder's wrong. Why? And those who don't think murder's wrong will think it's wrong when it happens in their house. The moral law defines a real difference between moral positions. C.S. Lewis again, he says, "The moment you say that one set of moral ideas can be better than another, you are in fact measuring them both by a standard, saying that one of them conforms to the standard more neatly than the other. But the standard that measures two things is something different from either." Continuing, he said, "You are in fact comparing them both with some real morality." And he capitalizes real morality. "Admitting that there is such a thing as real right, independent of what people think, and that some people's ideas get nearer to that right than others." Or put it this way, if your moral ideas can be truer than those of the Nazis, less true, there must be something, some real morality, for them to be true about. You're comparing who's right. We're all comparing who's right and what are we basing our right and wrong on. That's the moral argument. And again, we're trying to get back to, we're setting the tone of why we believe in right and wrong. And if there is a right and wrong, who says what's right? Who made that law? And is it standard throughout all generations of human beings? Those who espouse tolerance, for what? Why tolerate? This is big in our society, so hold on to this one. Remember it. We'll come back to it in a second. Thus, moral relativism must be false. If not, then there is no difference between Hitler and, say, Mother Teresa. If there is no moral law, if there are no moral absolutes, then if you put the goodness and all the good deeds of Mother Teresa over here and all the foulness of Adolf Hitler over here, you have to say there is no difference. Because what Hitler did over here, even though some people say it's bad, there are no moral absolutes, he thought it was right. Even though people say what Mother Teresa did was all good and feeding the poor, giving shelter to those who had none, it's neither right nor wrong. Do you see the absurdity of such? And if a professor, young people, wants to argue with you, the moment he or she begins to argue, they have proven they believe in the moral argument, in morality, that there are moral absolutes, because they will try to tell you you're wrong so that they can prove they're right. Isn't that right? You can't argue with it. If you're real, you just have to keep quiet. And what would be the point of teaching? What would be the point of education at all? We go to school. You're here tonight because you think this information is worthwhile. You think it will make you better. You think that this is a time of worship in a sense. and you opted to come here. This is good. All right? But you call it good. Others have opted to not come. Maybe they couldn't. Maybe they were tired. Maybe they opted to watch TV. Maybe they couldn't care less. Everyone's making decisions based upon what they think is the best thing to do. Some of you are here because you got dragged here. You're thinking, all right, it's probably best I just go because my spouse or my mom wants me to go. There's a lesser evil in me just doing what they want versus me rebelling, right? I'm not sure what number we're on, but the moral law tells us what is absolutely wrong because we inherently know what is absolutely right. Do you believe that? That we inherently know what is absolutely right? Do you think that there are people who grow up thinking that murder is right? I don't think anyone is born with the idea that murder is right or hurting another human being is right and okay. No one. There are people in prison today that if you interview them, I've read some interviews and seen some interviews. I'm an old criminal justice major, so had many case studies. And they will say things like, I grew up not thinking that this was wrong. And my question was always, as a counselor in return, why are you talking about that? To which their response would be, what do you mean? Well, if you didn't know it was wrong, why'd you bring it up? I mean, you didn't tell me that you chewed a piece of gum yesterday. You didn't tell me that you had ice cream with your mom when you were a 3-year-old. Why are you telling me out of nowhere that you didn't know this was wrong? If it's not wrong inherently in your mind, why'd you bring it up? I'll tell you why you brought it up. Because you knew it was wrong. It's on your mind. It's in your conscience. That's why, as you stand in front of a counselor, you brought it up first. Does that make sense? People know we are inherently inborn with the understanding that something is wrong. If you've read the book, Geisler quotes Alan Dershowitz. You know who Alan Dershowitz is? How many of you do know? He appeared a little bit more. He's always on the news. Not always, but he appears here and there now and then. He had some consultation in the O.J. Simpson case. He's a Jewish man, and he's quoted as saying, getting real riled up, very riled up guy, extremely liberal. And he says, we know what evil is. I don't know what is right. I know what's wrong. You don't know what's right. So, to say that abortion is right, for instance, as Dershowitz would say, is to say that women have the right to choose. But where did that come from? He, in his liberal ideas, are going to promote things like abortion rights. And we can use any example. I'm using abortion. If you're going to go to the carpet and say, a woman's right to choose is the inherent right of all women, where did you get that? Where did that come from? You are pushing, you are lobbying for an idea that you think is right. Alan Dershowitz is going to push every liberal policy in the book. Everything you believe, you want to know what Dershowitz believes, it's just the antithesis of what you believe as Christians. He dotes on that. But he thinks that's right. And he's going to stand up and say, we know what evil is. I'd like to say, how do you know what evil is? To say that you know what evil is means that you're comparing it to a good that you say you don't know. How can you know what evil is unless you know what good is? He was actually debating Alan Keyes when he said this. And Alan Keyes is Catholic, but Christian, and standing up for Christian rights, and he never got a word in. Frank Turk is saying, oh, I wish he would have gotten the chance to respond and been able to use what they're calling the roadrunner tactic in this book. Trip him out and say, well, how do you know what evil is? You're comparing it with good, but you can't ever get a word in with Dershowitz. How is it possible to know what's wrong unless you know what's right? Do you think that that's a good argument? So if you take anything away from this, young people, tonight, you're talking to a professor. Professor's telling you what you should believe and how everything is subjective. Ask them, if you believe everything is subjective, you obviously believe that's right. What are you comparing that against? And how can one thing be right and the other thing be wrong when you yourself are telling us that not everything is right or wrong? If you think that alphabet soup behind a person's name makes them smart, it typically means they're the dumbest people on the planet. And I mean it with common sense. They are brilliant in their scientific understanding, in all the work that they've done. I've got some letters behind my name. I'm blasting myself. But really it comes down to, do you know Christ? Every single time, do you know Christ? Because once you know Christ, all of this worldview makes perfect sense. If you don't, you're borrowing from the worldview of Christianity, saying there's right and wrong, to make your atheistic worldview fit. The moral law is the grounds for political and social dissent. We've kind of moved up to this point. In government and in Hollywood, liberals espouse opposition to war, anti-abortion laws, etc. But in having no God, what are their objective grounds for holding to any position? Why? In Hollywood, you see these people. Hollywood, they march for their rights. Why? What right do they have? Okay, you've got this. These liberals, they espouse an opposition to war. Why is it wrong to go to war? Because our young men are dying over there? Well, now what's the problem with war now? Now it's murder. The president sending these troops over murdering our young men and women, right? At least that's their idea. Okay, now at least we have a basis here. Murdering is wrong. Allowing people to die is wrong. Where did they get that? Where does that idea come from? And you got to ask yourself, when you see these people fighting for their cause, again, over and over, where do they get this idea? What makes them think that? You and I believe murder is wrong because God said murder is wrong. They're stealing from us. There is no right to an abortion, homosexual sex, or any of their other political sacraments, because in a non-theistic world, there are no rights. You and I believe in rights because we believe that man was created in the image of God. Fish are not out fighting for the right to not be eaten by bigger fish. Little bunnies are not fighting for their right to not be eaten by wolves. Why? Because they were not made in man's image, in God's image. We were made in God's image to have fellowship with God. And if there is no God, what right is there for any of these things to exist? What right is there for me to live? I said it last week. Let me reiterate it again. If survival of the fittest is actually true, and it is, by the way, the strong do survive. And if it's true morally, then if any of you are to get in my way, I should draw my gun and shoot you. And there should be no consequences. Because in evolution, if you threaten me and I'm stronger than you, then I win. If your existence threatens mine, then in the survival of the fittest, why can't I eliminate you? Or vice versa. Makes no sense. Why have we stopped? People say, well, wait a minute, that's the way we've evolved too. Now we must stop. Who says? Who or what says that? Well, people in general. So are people in general the law? Wherever you stop, there is a law. And it comes from somewhere. If the majority of the people who have evolved from the slime have come up and said one day, we need to stop doing this, then does the majority of right within that group of people, is that what constitutes right and wrong? Something does, somewhere. And if so, why? Why would that group? You should always question it. Why? Why would the group? Why can't I alone say, no, we should keep being able to kill people if they threaten my existence? After all, if all of you came together having evolved from the slime and you're telling me, look, we've decided that killing is wrong and we need to stop. And we've done that for our own survival up to this point, but we need to stop. And I would say, wait a minute. What makes you right? I think I'm right. I'll go out, I'll be the hero, and we'll get back on with evolution. That way I'll kill all of you. You're not right over me. Why would the majority rule over the minority? Who says that? It's absurd. By rebelling against the moral law, atheists have ironically undermined their grounds for rebelling against anything. They cannot rebel because the moment they rebel, they're digging their feet into a moral law that they believe is real. If there were no moral law, then we wouldn't make excuses for violating it. It's like I was talking about in counseling those who have murdered. Why'd they bring it up? Why'd that come up first? Even tolerance reveals a moral law, which is prevalent in our society because it is a moral principle. We'll tolerate. And we all tolerate one another, don't we? You tolerate your spouse. Tolerate your kids. You're tolerating me right now. You're tolerating the chair. You're tolerating whether or not you're cold or hot. You're tolerating whether or not your coffee is cold or hot or your drink is watered down or still strong. We're tolerating all the time. But on a moral level, we're on a different level. If there is no moral law, why be tolerant? Because promoting tolerance is promoting a viewpoint that people think is right. And it also implies the plea to be tolerant is a tacit admission that the behavior to be tolerated is wrong. Why? Because you don't need to plead with people to tolerate good behavior. tolerate Greg. He's a very nice, fine gentleman. He'll treat you right. Matter of fact, when he shakes your hand, he gives you a $5 bill every time. You need to tolerate all of his niceties and all the ways he helps you feel good. Tolerate that. Do we need anybody to do that? We don't need people to tell us to tolerate that. Well, if he was just the opposite, we would need to tolerate it. Why? Because we don't like the opposite behavior to tolerate him. And so that we believe the good should be the standard and we tolerate the bad. So that we don't hurt Greg's feelings. So even in the world we live in, which says tolerate everything, there is a moral underlying basis that something is to be tolerated, which is not good. No one makes excuses for doing good unless it embarrasses them to do so. We just don't go around making excuses. I gave $100 to that lady over there. Please forgive me. I'm so sorry that I did a good deed. I know it was a bad thing to tell this little girl to wipe her face. I know that was a bad thing to do. I'm so sorry. No one does that. But we always make excuses and feel guilty for something that we do that's questionable. Always. Especially to the pastor or a counselor. They come in and, if I'm doing marriage counseling, both parties immediately go into why they're right. It's always that way. Oh, everybody stop. Let's start over here first. You give your story, all right? You give your story. Each one are fighting against the other because each one's fighting for their rights. Each one believes they're right. Neither one has remembered that they're both wrong. And if they would just shut up and listen to the other, they could actually come back together, which supposedly is the ultimate good, but who says? We should just divorce. When you get into a fight, you should just leave and go find somebody else. And if that doesn't work, you should leave and find somebody else. If I taught that, do you think I'd need to make an excuse for it? How about if I taught you need to stay with your spouse and work it out? Do I need to make an excuse for that? You see how inherent the moral law is? And what we're getting to at the end is if that exists, and we know it does, who gave it to us? From the moral law, we know that God is, number one, absolutely morally pure. And since it is apparent that a God exists, then the opposite of a theistic universe must be false. All that means is, if we know there is a God through the ontological argument, through the cosmological argument, through the teleological argument, through the moral argument, or just one of those, we know there's a God. If there is a God, then that means all atheistic and agnostic religions are wrong. Because you can't have a universe where there is a God and there be atheism too. Those don't coexist, do they? Either one is true and the other false, or they're both false. Of course, they both can't be false because there's no God, there's no God. It's one or the other. Thus, all atheistic and all agnostic faiths are wrong because there is a God. Because if atheism is right, then there would be no moral law. There can't be. It's absolutely absurd for there to exist a moral law in an atheistic, no-God universe. Furthermore, in reference to the answer of which God is true, note this. Stay awake. The moral law disproves polytheism because God is infinite. Polytheism meaning there's many gods. We've already said there's a God. Now let's see whether or not there's many gods. Logically speaking, the moral law disproves polytheism because God is infinite and there cannot be more than one infinite being. To distinguish one being from the other, in such a case, they must differ in some way. In other words, if there's two infinite, all-purpose, all-powerful beings, then they must differ in some way. And if they differ in some way, then one lacks something that the other one has. If one lacks something that the other one has, then the lacking being is not infinite, because an infinite being, by definition, lacks nothing. I know it's late. I know it's been a long day, but did you get that? He's just proven on the previous slide I showed you that because God exists, atheism and agnosticism are wrong because there's a God. If there is an infinite, all-powerful God, and we know there is, then that means he has to just be one. Because they can't be two. If they're two, they're identical. And in which case, you would need one over the other. Or one would have hair and the other one would not have hair or something like that. Which means that one's lacking something, and yet by definition, an infinite being lacks nothing. Even hair. Come on, I see the wheels turning. Let that one sink in, Kelly. Okay, it does. But if something is infinite and has existed for eternity, far beyond our human comprehension, then such a being has always existed. Such a being must be perfect. Such a being is in its inconceivable way, or its most conceivable way in the ontological argument, is the greatest. There is no greater than that which can be conceived in all of his greatness. So just being infinite makes that one eternal. I'm sorry. Just being infinite makes that one necessary and absolutely all-powerful because he's infinite. He lacks nothing. He's made everything. He can lack nothing. It's a philosophical equation. I know it takes time to sink in. Think about it. Think through it. But in the logic here, if there is a God, then there is no atheism and agnosticism. And if that God is infinite, which the ontological argument and the cosmological argument demand, then he can only be one. Therefore, all polytheistic religions are also out the door. There can only be one infinite being. What's left among the religions to choose from are Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, which are all theistic religions, one God. So now we've narrowed everything down to three religions. Among all the religions of the world, these are the only monotheistic religions. Well, now it's easy. We just get to pick three, right? Pick one of three. And using the law of non-contradiction, mutually exclusive religions cannot all be true. Only one of these can be true. We can't say, well, they're all true. Islam is completely against Judaism and Christianity. Christianity is against Islam. Christianity is against the beliefs of the Jews while employing many of the beliefs of the Jews. Only one can be right. So which one we choose, we'll have to be very careful with. Thus, all other religions, atheism, agnosticism, and polytheism must be false because there is a God and he is infinite. It's the only way that we can account for our existence at all, that God and such a God exists. Six confusions as we close. I know, I'm getting finished early tonight. Well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe these will take longer than I think. Don't get too excited. Number one. There are absolute morals versus changing behaviors. First of all, look at the idea, 50 years ago and more, living together was unheard of. I mean, it was there, and it was done, by the free spirits who didn't care. Today, the same people that live together come to church together, right? And I had to preach a sermon one time, and actually I was informed afterwards that the man and the woman who were visiting that day were living together. And I told the guy that brought them, I said, you need to tell them that you can't do that. And you certainly can't partake of the Lord's Supper like they did while living together. And I'm glad to talk to them about this, but since you brought them, just explain it to them very kindly. That's not really what we do here. And Lance is afraid for your soul if that's what you opt to do. Well, you didn't see that in Ward Cleaver and June Cleaver days, right? But times have changed. People will say, you know what, Lance, get with the program. People are doing that all the time. What's the big deal? Why do you need a ceremony? You're living together. Will one ceremony change everything? They're going to go back to the same house and keep living together, aren't they? Why don't we just take it to the next level? Since we're devolving, let's just say, you know what, you can murder anybody you want. Who cares? The moral standard is always the same. The behaviors around it change. And sadly, Christians today buy into those changing behaviors. More and more. You've heard the illustration, the parable of the frog in the kettle. I've used it 1,000 times here. Take a lukewarm pot of water, get you a frog, put the frog in this kettle, in this pot of water. I'm assuming he'll stay in there. I've not tried this. And he'll stay in there. Now, if you drop the frog into a boiling pan, he jumps out. But if you put him in this lukewarm pan of water, and you turn up the heat slowly and boil it, the frog burns up. And that's the way Christians are today. We're living in a society that is slowly getting more, or I should say, less and less moral. And you and I are buying into it. We're buying into the idea of tolerance. It's okay, we'll let them come in, as long as they're in church, right? They're here. No. Where does it say that? Why should we just be happy that they're in church? The churches that espouse such things, I promise you there's not going to be a sermon that's ever going to be preached. It's ever going to make these people uncomfortable. The gospel makes people uncomfortable because it hits everything we do as wrong. There it is. That's why you show up for more. You like to be wrong. Number two, absolute morals versus the changing perceptions of the facts. In the Salem witch trials, the perception of witches then and now has changed. We don't kill witches today. But we still do believe murder's wrong. Salem witch trials weren't so much about witches as they were about murder. people were dying, and they were attributing it to witches casting spells. And so they found a way to try to root out witches. But really, what was the underlying problem? Not witches, but murder. Have we changed? We have changed. We don't kill witches, but we still kill murderers. Or we at least arrest them and put them in jail. It's always, the moral standard has always been wrong. What we think causes it has changed. We've grown up. Absolute morals, number three, versus applying them to particular situations. Consider five people on an airplane, and there's four parachutes. And we'll go around and we say, well, Marty, he should live because he's so stinking good looking. You can't have such a beautiful man die, so let's give him a parachute. That embarrass you? Amy, she's got the best laugh in the world, and she thinks Lance is so funny. We got to have her because somebody's got to laugh at the preacher's jokes. So let's keep Amy. Clint, we can let him go. She could do better, right? At any rate, we find four, and we kick Nathan out because, you know, Nathan just comes up lacking amongst the people. Sorry, Nathan. I use the best for that, right? And we try to figure out which one's right, which one's wrong. Who's the least important? What are we doing? What's the underlying issue here? Throw them all out of the plane. There's nothing wrong with it. Throw them all out. Tear the parachutes. Who cares? What? Murder's wrong. Murder's not wrong, I mean. Who cares who lives? The whole parable assumes that it's wrong for someone to die, does it not? Do you see the assumption? You come into an argument and there's an assumption on every part or amongst every party involved. Absolute command versus a relative culture, which is what and how. For instance, greeting. We look at this in the Bible. Paul says, greet one another with a holy kiss. We don't do that. We're a Bible church. I'm asking you to not obey the Bible. But really, that was just the form. Or I should say the function. The form is the greeting. And I think that true Christians, true nice people, greet. In our culture, it's an embrace, a handshake, a salute of sorts, a recognition of the person. I can't stand people that walk by, they look, they say nothing. And lots of people are like that. Not here per se. I'm offended by that, are you? A person created in the image of God, you walk by, I walk down the green belt in Fairfield every day, and I make people speak. You're going to say hello to me. How you doing? You Yankees back there in Maine.
Go to New England, man. Nobody says anything.
Nobody says anything. Yeah. Absolutely. And they think you're nutcase when you say hello.
I was shocked when I came down here and said,
what, you talking to me? Right. And that's the way all people from up north think when they come down south. Is it a southern thing or is it just a friendly thing? In the church you greet. But the form in which we greet is different. But that we greet is the most important thing, is it not? And I'm going to open this can of worms quickly. You can ask me questions later about it. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul speaks of a woman wearing a hat. And he demands it. Let a woman wear a hat. But what is he talking about? The entire context of what he's talking about is a wife submitting to her husband. And in that culture, she told the world, I submit to this man by wearing a hat. We don't do that today. Would it be a good thing if we did? Sure, why not? But I would still say, and I think you would agree, that it's better to submit than just wear a hat. Some women wear hats and they're still not going to submit. Why not just do what the Bible says? We have a different cultural norm. You wear a ring today to be married. A woman typically takes a man's last name, but that doesn't mean she's submitting. There's a difference between form and function. The command is to greet. The command is to submit. We might show it in different ways. The important thing is that we do it. The culture is relative. The command is absolute. Absolute morals versus moral disagreements. Differing opinions about abortion, for instance, do not demonstrate that morality is relative, as many say. The tension exists because abortionists are suppressing the moral law innate within them. And I'll tell you my own experience with abortion. And that is that those I have counseled, and I've obviously only had a small sample of the entire world's population, are living with a horribly guilty conscience. And what do you do when you're guilty? You try to justify what you did. Constantly. The ones that drop their guard are the ones that drop everything and pour over their guilt of the life that they killed. As a counselor, hey, you are forgiven. The Lord loves you. You made a mistake. You can be set free from your sin. God loves you. I can do that. You can do that. It's that moral idea of what we did that they know is wrong that they fight and battle for to make it right. Now, just because we argue over something, does that mean it's not absolute? Well, try to figure out, why is one arguing, does one argue against chocolate over vanilla? Is that a moral argument? Is taking another life moral? We're talking about life. We're talking about morality. Ice cream colors and tastes are not moral. How do we know that? Although everyone would agree with it, yet we still don't know how. Well, you and I know. And absolute ends versus relative means. All want to help the poor. If you take our clashes in the government, well, both liberal and conservatives want to help the poor. That's the moral law. They want the poor to be helped. But they have differing opinions as to which way is the best. You might say that the Republicans want to train the poor people to work. The Democrats just want to give them more money so that they don't ever have to work, so that they can get their votes, so they can stay in power. Which one's going to go? Well, depends on how many people vote for the other one. But what are they after? The rights of the poor. And they act like they care for the poor. So that's the bottom line. A good leader would go in and say, all right, we all agree, liberals and conservatives, that we all want what we think is best. Now we have to figure out how we can compromise on both of our sides to get to that best way, or to get to that way the best by compromising to that goal that we share. In conclusion, without a moral law, we have no higher moral value than the slime that we evolved from. We're just evolved slime. Our moral evolution into what we currently believe has no basis whatsoever without the moral law. You can't defend anything you believe unless there is a moral law and a moral lawgiver. Thus, since there is certainly a moral law, and we all agree, there must be a moral lawgiver. We believe it's God. Evolved people might say, well, it's the society we live in. Where did they get that? That the giver is God, the first cause, eternal necessary being, by and through which all things have their being, is what we believe. We believe that in the beginning, through the ontological and cosmological arguments for the existence of God, that there is an eternal necessary being that made everything that exists. We believe that that God is the lawgiver of everything that is good and right. And the antithesis of that is the rebellion against that moral lawgiver. Now, people today believe in right and wrong, and they don't necessarily believe in God. That means they're stealing from the worldview given to us in God's Word, handed down to us by this eternal, existing, necessary being. So it is.